Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. This week we present podcast number 82, The Story of Lazarus, as we delve into some spiritual ideas. I'm George Taylor. About 2 weeks ago, I spent some time with two families who are close to me. Both of these families were dealing with the loss of a parent in that family. When I came back home to my home church on the following weekend, our preaching minister in my home congregation, Joey Davis, presented the story of Lazarus. Now, this story touched me, and this presentation touched me very deeply, and I think a lot of it was because of dealing with the losses of these two families in the prior week. Both of them touched me deeply. This story took on an eternal perspective that really reached into my heart. You may not have the same reaction, but I want to share this lesson with you. I think it's powerful, and it's definitely biblical and helpful to look at. Let's start by reading the story as it appears in the New Living Translation. We're in John chapter 11. A man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in Bethany with his sisters, Mary and Martha. This is the Mary who later poured the expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was sick. So the two sisters sent a message to Jesus telling him, "Lord, your dear friend is very sick." But when Jesus heard about it, he said, "Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this." So although Jesus loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. Finally, he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." But his disciples objected. "Rabbi," they said, "only a few days ago the people in Judea were trying to stone you. Are you going there again?" Jesus replied, "There are 12 hours of daylight in every day. During the day, people can walk safely. They can see because they have the light of this world. But at night, there is danger of stumbling because they have no light." Then he said, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but now I will go and wake him up." The disciples said, "Lord, if he is sleeping, he will soon get better." They thought Jesus meant Lazarus was simply sleeping, but Jesus meant Lazarus had died. So he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And for your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there, for now you will really believe. Come, let's go see him." Thomas, nicknamed the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let's go too and die with Jesus." When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he was told that Lazarus had already been in his grave for 4 days. Bethany was only a few miles down the road from Jerusalem, and many of the people had come to console Mary and Martha in their loss. When Martha got word that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him, but Mary stayed in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had only been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus told her, "Your brother will rise again." "Yes," said Martha, "he will rise when everyone else rises, at the last day." Jesus told her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, even after dying. Everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha?" "Yes, Lord," she told him. "I have always believed you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who has come into the world from God." Then she returned to Mary. She called Mary aside from the mourners and told her, "The teacher is here and wants to see you." So Mary immediately went to him. Jesus had stayed outside the village at the place where Martha met him. When the people who were at the house consoling Mary saw her leave so hastily, they assumed she was going to Lazarus's grave to weep, so they followed her there. When Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had only been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. "Where have you put him?" he asked them. They told him, "Lord, come and see." Then Jesus wept. The people who were standing nearby said, "See how much he loved him." But some said, "This man healed a blind man. Couldn't he have kept Lazarus from dying?" Jesus was still angry as he arrived at the tomb, a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. "Roll the stone aside," Jesus told them. But Martha, the dead man's sister, protested, "Lord, he has been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible." Jesus responded, "Didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe?" So they rolled the stone aside. Then Jesus looked up to heaven and said, "Father, thank you for hearing me. You always hear me, but I said it out loud for the sake of all these people standing here, so that they will believe you sent me." Then Jesus shouted, "Lazarus, come out!" And the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound in grave clothes, his face wrapped in a headcloth. Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him go."
I think it's interesting that Kurtwood Smith, who is the actor that was on this particular clip in this particular show, is an accomplished actor. He's classically trained Broadway actor. He was in the movie Oklahoma. He is a singer and a dancer. And for the rest of his life, he will be an angry old man named Red Foreman. And it's funny how what things we're known for. That sometimes we're known for things that we do. Sometimes we're known for things that happen to us that we had no control over. But somehow, some way, that's going to be the one thing that sticks in people's minds. This morning, we have a story about such a person. It wasn't what he did. It was what was done to him, for him, through him. And it showed the power of God in some mighty ways. This is the last in this series of called Risen. Our first lesson was in 1 Kings chapter 17 about how Elijah raised the widow's son. And the main thread in that is that faith isn't the absence of fear, but faith is obedience in the face of fear. And then last week, we talked about another resurrection story, and the thread is that the strength of our faith is not as important as the object of our faith. And when we think about Jairus and his daughter, it was the object of Jairus' faith that was powerful. It wasn't necessarily the strength of his faith. And this week, we're going to tell the most famous resurrection story besides the resurrection of Jesus. And it's the resurrection of Lazarus. If you will, join me in John chapter 11. And we're going to read verses 1 through 3 to begin. It says, Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sister sent word to him, saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." A little context here. It's obvious that Jesus has a deep relationship with Mary and with Martha and with Lazarus. It's not the last time we'll hear from Mary and Martha and Lazarus. We know that Jesus goes to their house to teach, and Martha's running around like a mad woman trying to get things prepared for food, and Mary's sitting at Jesus' feet hearing his teachings, and Martha, type A Martha, "Would you tell her to get up and help me out? I mean, come on, and she needs to get on the same page with me." And Mary just wanted to be with Jesus. And Jesus answers Martha. She's chosen the best thing. It was obvious that there was something deep in this relationship. We know that Mary was the woman who had anointed Jesus' feet with oil, and he wiped it with her hair, taking a big risk to even touch a man of the opposite sex, and what impropriety it was for her to take her headdressing off in order to show her hair in public. But she did that because she was willing to take a risk to serve her master. There was obviously something deep going on here, even to the point that when Mary and Martha send for Jesus, they don't say it's Lazarus, they say it's the one you love. In the book of John, the only other person that's called a disciple that Jesus loved is John himself. So obviously there's a relationship going on here. But their problem here is not necessarily that Jesus wouldn't help. Their problem was his timing. It was the common thread through this lesson is God doesn't always work the way we want him to when we want him to do it. In this case, the timing of Jesus tells us that he wasn't really in all that big a hurry. We go down to verses 6 and 7, and it says, "So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, 'Let's go to Judea again.'" Pretty circuitous route. You see, Jesus was in no hurry to get to Lazarus. Mary and Martha, meanwhile, are by Lazarus. He's sick, wringing their hands, knowing that this could be the end. Because for most people, death is that final thing. It is that period at the end of the story. And for Mary and Martha, they were facing this in their own life. Can you imagine how his delay angered Mary and Martha? Can you imagine how troubled in spirit they felt? Because they had called for the Lord, and he just didn't move. The frustration that they had, you know, comes out in the story. You know, when Jesus does finally decide that he will come and he'll tend to Lazarus and to Mary and Martha, we read in verse 21, it says, Martha then said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And then when Mary gets her turn, she says exactly the same thing in verse 32. When Mary came with Jesus, what she saw him, fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." God's delay can anger his followers. God's delay can perplex his followers. And in this particular case, this frustration happens even to the most faithful of people. I will guarantee you in this room, there are many people, including myself, who have wanted God to act, but not only wanted God to act, but they were very sure about when they wanted God to act. When it comes to God acting in our life, we're all certain of what we want God to do and when we want God to do it. And sometimes it feels like God is not working at the appropriate speed, that he's not making the appropriate haste. And somehow, some way, he just isn't working like we thought he would. It's almost like sometimes I say to God, "God, here's my to-do list. Here's what I want to see happen. And by the way, here's the best window of opportunity for you to get that done." And in this story, we learn four things about God's timing. And it's kind of interesting. The first two things are about the nature of God. And the last two things are about how God interacts with the nature of man. The first thing that we learn in this lesson, quite simply, is that God almost never works on our schedule. Now, it shouldn't surprise you, but it does. It shouldn't surprise any of us. God doesn't almost never works according to our schedule. But when you think about it, time is really relative. It's especially relative to God, who created eternity, and time means something but is meaningless all at the same time. You know, even in our society, time is a relative thing. You know, some people think 30 minutes late is fashionably late. You go to other cultures, if you're an hour late, you're still early. Even our marriages. I know that with Melissa and I, our sense of timing is completely different. She believes in being fashionably late. It's okay to be right on time or maybe just a little bit late, and that's a good thing. For me, early is on time and on time is late. You can imagine the stress that has put in our marriage. Now, to flip that over, and to be fair, there are times that Melissa will say, "Joey, take out the garbage." Now, her sense of timing there is, "Joey, take out the garbage right now." And my sense of timing is, "Joey will take out the garbage if he just happens to be walking by the garbage can and remember that he said he would." It's that whole sense of timing. And when you think about that with us and in our relationships, should it surprise you that God's sense of timing sometimes can confuse us, and that God's sense of timing sometimes can confound us. But I want to also propose this, is that if we impose our sense of timing on God, we will always feel unloved by Him. If we attach timing to God's providence, to God's love and God's concern for us, we will always feel unloved by God. Even in this story, Mary and Martha obviously have a deep relationship with Jesus. Lazarus has this abiding relationship. He's even called someone that Jesus loved. Yet God doesn't act, and Jesus delays, and they feel unloved. They feel ignored. Maybe you feel the same way. Maybe you feel unloved because you want God to act in your life, and there are things that you feel that you need, and you need them on a time schedule, and it's very appropriate that God work at this window of opportunity. Yet when He does not, we feel broken and unloved. Mary and Martha understood this, and they were wondering, why in the world were they on the back burner? You see, basically 1A here is, you know, we need to know that God almost never works on our schedule. The second thing is, you can't hurry Jesus. This is 1A. If you look in this story, there's a couple of things that just jump off the page at you when you think about timing. Jesus got there, according to Mary and Martha, late. According to Jesus, Jesus got there exactly when He intended to. He got there exactly when He thought was the right time for Him to be there, or else He would not have delayed the way He did. And the second thing I find is interesting is, not only did He get there right when He intended to, but Jesus made no excuses and He gave no apologies. He shows up. There's nothing like, there was a 20 donkey pileup on the road to Judea and we just were like 2 days late. It wasn't that. He shows up, He hears them speak, He returns a sentence to each, and then He basically, in His own way, says, just trust me. Trust my timing. Trust that I am who I say I am. Well, the second thing is that, you know, God almost never works according to our schedule, but also, God knows more than we do. That's another thing, shouldn't surprise us, right? But it's the nature of God. That somehow, some way, God knows more than we do, and He knows things that we can't possibly comprehend. You know, in life, timing's everything, isn't it? If you think about it, in your job, timing's everything. In the games we play, in the sports that we play, timing is everything. A second too slow, a second too fast means the world. In games, even in relationships, timing is everything. But you have to understand that we worship a God that transcends time. And so when we have a God who transcends time, we also have a God who knows beyond what we can know and sees beyond what we can see. I mean, through Isaiah, He says these words in Isaiah 55:8. He says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, and your ways are not my ways. And He's saying, listen, I see what you can't see. I know what you can't know. And so when it comes to my timing, you have to understand, I have information that you just don't have. You see, my issue with God's timing always boils down to arrogance. The reality is, and this is Joey Davis' true confession time, reality is, I think I got all the information I need to inform God as to what He needs to do, and also to tell Him exactly when He needs to do it. I feel competent to let God know that this is how He should be working in my life. And the problem is, when it comes to looking at God and saying things like that, He's incredibly arrogant. And in this story, it's interesting, we need to look at what Jesus knew long before He speaks to Mary and Martha. In John 11:11, Jesus says this. After that, He said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, which in this case is dead, but I go so that I may awaken him out of his sleep. Now once again, He hasn't shown up with Mary and Martha. He knows that Lazarus is dead, although He hasn't been told that Lazarus is dead. And He says, he's fallen asleep, and I'm going for the sole purpose of lifting him and raising him out of this sleep. You see, Mary and Martha believed in the afterlife, but they had never seen anything quite like this. They'd heard the stories, but never seen it. But there was more to that. What Jesus knew is he knew that he intended to raise Lazarus from the dead, but he also knew that he intended to affect more people around Lazarus than just his family, Mary and Martha. He wanted his disciples to see it. In chapter 11, verses 14 and 15, it says, "So Jesus said to them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there.'" He's saying, I'm going to go there, and it's going to be good for all of you to see what's about to happen. Here's what's going on. They had heard the stories, probably the stories that I've told you. They knew the story of Elijah raising the widow's son, but they needed to have a tangible proof that Jesus would raise his people. And this was going to be it. He would tangibly, hands-on, taste, touch, feel, and after 4 days in the grave, smell. They would know that Jesus truly would raise people from the dead. He would demonstrate his power over death. So when we're angry and disillusioned, in my own life, I'm going through this right now. Sometimes you feel like, God, are you even there? Because you are not acting fast enough in this situation that is breaking my heart. And so when we're going through that, I ask that we all consider this. That when we're considering God's timing, we need to be open to the idea there might be a massive piece of information that he knows that we just don't know. When it comes to God working in our life, he doesn't work on our time, and he knows things that we don't know. And the reality is this. Someday you may understand why he's delaying in your life. You may understand why he's waiting two more days to act, or he's taking a circuitous route to get to your trouble and your sorrow, your brokenness, or your mourning. Someday you might know, but you may never know. You may never get a good answer for that. And so when we look at this fact about who God is, that God knows what we don't know, can we just do this? Can we just trust him to do what's best when it's best, simply because he's God and we're not? Simply because he is the all-knowing ruler of time, space, and dimension, and we're not. His thoughts aren't our thoughts. Our ways aren't his ways. The third thing, and this has to do with how Jesus interacts with us. You see, in this story, not only do we find out that God doesn't work on our time and that he knows things that we don't know, and he was setting this whole thing up for Mary and Martha and Lazarus long before they even saw him come on the scene, but we also find out that Jesus has this way of entering into our sorrow and our brokenness and our mourning and our life. I mean, the very gut wrenching level part of our life. He has a way of entering into those things after he's already overcome them. You got to remember, he knew Lazarus had died and he planned on raising him from the dead. But he still showed up and he entered into the sorrow and the brokenness of both Mary and Martha before he ever raised Lazarus physically from the dead. I find it interesting in this text that as John records the interaction between Jesus and Martha, and then he records the interaction between Jesus and Mary, that both Mary and Martha say exactly the same thing, word for word. If you go and you look in Scripture, you're going to see they both say the same thing. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Exactly the same thing. But Jesus responds to these two women very differently. Now, I'm going to be a theology Bible study nerd for just a minute and share something with you that you've probably thought about. And that's that, you know what? The one limitation of the written word is that in these words, you don't have tone with the quotes. You know, it's like you could say something with an emphasis on a different word in the sentence and it would change the meaning of the sentence completely. Such as I could look at Paul and I could say, "I did not say you stole my book," which means somebody may have stole my book, but I don't think it's you. Or, "I did not say you stole my book," which means somebody said it, but I didn't say it. And you can't really hear inflections and tone. But I have a feeling that even though these two women said the same words, they were said in a different way. Because remember, we know things about Mary and Martha, don't we? Martha's type A. She's the march straight ahead, take the hill kind of woman. And so she walks up to Jesus and she's the first one there. And Lord, if you had just been there, my brother would not have died. And did you notice what he said to her when you read the story? In verse 25 and 26, that Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. And he who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? It's interesting. Because this type A, this Martha, this head up, neck up, information kind of person, it's like, I know who you are. If you had been here, you've made other sick people well, you could have done this. And he's saying, do you really believe I am who I am? It's a declaration about who he is. A knowledge saying, do you know who you're talking to? It's not a coincidence that John begins his book, that he begins this whole manuscript by saying, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And all things that came into being through him, and without him, nothing that came into being. And in this passage, John records that Jesus reminded Martha, I was in the beginning. I created life, and I can recreate life. And I can bring life into places where there is no life at all. I can heal your brokenness. And I can enter into your sorrow, but I've overcome all those things already. But I will walk through those things with you. And so he speaks to her, and she claims her belief in the resurrection. And then they go and they get Mary. Mary, the one who knelt at his feet. Mary, the one who took a risk just to be with him. Mary, the one who ignored the things that needed to be done because in her heart there was something that needed to be fed. The one who sat at his feet and listened to his teaching. And they call Mary up and she says the exact same thing. Lord, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. Did it sound different? Lord, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. And then, Lord, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. And what we see Jesus do with Mary is just so different. In verses 33 through 35, it says, when Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled and said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. The shortest verse in Scripture, Jesus wept. It was one thing to make a proclamation to Martha to say, do you know who you're talking to? I've got this. But when it came to Mary, all he wanted to do was grieve with her. This valley of the shadow of death that she was wading through, all he wanted to do was wade through it with her. He wanted to enter into her brokenness. And so he cried because she was crying. He allowed himself to be broken because she was broken. And you have to wonder, why would he do this? What makes the difference? Because the outcome is going to be the same, right? I mean, when you read the story and you realize what's going on in the story, the outcome is going to be the same for both Mary and Martha. In about 10 minutes, we're going to see something happen that they had never seen happen before. Lazarus is going to come out of a grave. In about 10 minutes, they're going to be taking the death clothes off of Lazarus, and they're going to say, dude, you stink. It's time to get a bath. And for both of them, in about 10 minutes, they're going to get their brother back. So why would he address them this way? And it's because collectively there was a teaching taking place. There were people that were behind him and around them when he was speaking. You see, Jesus enters into our sorrow because he doesn't only relate to us on the basis of his divinity, but also on the basis of his humanity. In this story, through his interaction, he makes a proclamation about who he is, his divinity, that he is God. But he also has the ability to wade through the brokenness in their lives. It's a beautiful side of a multifaceted God. And also want you to see this. You know, the delay of God and God's love for us are not incompatible. God can love us and still delay. But also want you to consider that it's during this time of delay that God enters into our brokenness most. It was during these 10 minutes between when they met him at the road and when he called Lazarus out of a grave, it was during those minutes that Jesus entered into that sorrow. It was during those minutes that we knew that he really cared. It was during those minutes that he says, not only am I God, but I'm man and I love you. And it's during those times that he enters into our life. It's during the time where we're waiting and we're thinking, God, why aren't you acting in the time that I think you should act? Why aren't you doing the things that I think you should do? And why aren't you doing them right now? It's during those moments that he enters into our brokenness. And it's during those moments that he enters into our sorrow. And it's during those moments that he reveals himself in colors so vivid that we can't imagine. It's because he has the ability to enter into our sorrow and our brokenness and our mourning long after he's overcome them already. For me, the most powerful part of this lesson, though, is point number 4. You know, so far we've talked about God almost never works according to our schedule. God knows more than we do, things that we can't even perceive or understand, and that God does enter into our sorrow even after he's already overcome them. But to me, in this passage, it tells us something else about Jesus, and it's about his nature and his nature, how he feels about us. Jesus literally, in this passage, rages against death. He's angry. Now, if you don't study the text and you don't look at it carefully, it's very easy to overlook this. But I want us to read these passages together, 38 and 39, first of it, and then 41 through 44. Said, so Jesus, again, being deeply moved, and being deeply moved is key here. We'll get back to that in a minute. Being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. And now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. And Jesus said, remove the stone. And the in-between part here is that, well, he stinks, so you're going to bring him out. And then verse 41, so they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me. And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice. Why a loud voice? You're going to find out in a minute. Lazarus, come forth. The man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth, and Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Now, I told you earlier that in verse 38 it says, him being deeply moved within. A lot of people would say, and would translate that in their mind, saying that Jesus was just so very, very sad. But the Greek word, the Greek translation of this, of what John had to say, is much different. Because the Greek translation was that he was gut angry. That he was deeply moved, but he was deeply moved with an angry passion. And the question is, what was he angry about? Was he angry at Mary? If you had been here, my brother had died. Of course not. It's a broken person. Someone that was hurt. Was he angry at Martha? Even though she was type A and the first one to march up to him, would he be angry with him? No, he's not angry. Is he angry with Lazarus? Well, Lazarus has nothing to do with his anger. So what is he angry about? Jesus is angry at death. I know it sounds very literary when I say it, but Jesus in this story is angry at death. He's angry at the author of death. He's angry at the enemy. He's angry at what death steals out of the lives of the people around. He's angry at how death chips away at our faith. He's angry about how death destroys hope. He's angry about death. If you turn back one chapter in Scripture, it says this in John 10:10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. And he stands in front of this grave with one woman angry and one woman crying, and he realizes that their hope is gone. And that in some way it has stolen, it has killed, and it has destroyed in this one instance. And he's angry that death has this kind of power because of the purpose that Jesus came for. Jesus came for one thing. You hear me say the one thing all the time? He came for one thing, and he did it a lot of different ways. But what Jesus came to this world to do was to restore what death had destroyed. He did it through his teachings. He did it through healing of the sick. He did it through love. But he came to restore what death had stolen and killed and destroyed. And he was angry at death. And so in his anger, he shouted, Lazarus, come forth! And he came out.
This is beautiful because what we see in this story is a microcosm of really how he works in the lives of people. You see, occasionally God breaks into the brokenness of our world, and he does for one what he will eventually do for all who are in Christ. That's what's happening here. You think of all the stories of Jesus and the things that he did. I think of the story at Bethesda as Jesus wades into this humanity of sick people beside the waters of Bethesda. And he walks over to this one guy who had been coming there for numerous years because he was sick, hoping that some miracle would happen in his life. And he, the man being lame, he tells him to rise and walk. He stands, and they walk back out of that sea of humanity together. He does for one what he'll eventually do for everybody. Those who can't walk will walk again. He finds a person that can't see, and he spits in the dirt, and he makes mud pies, and he puts it on their eyes. Just one. Could he have healed every blind person? Sure he could have, but he entered into that brokenness to do for one what he's eventually going to do for everyone. The blind will see again. Because we know through the revelation that John also wrote that when we get to that wonderful place that God has prepared for us, there'll be no more crying, there'll be no more pain, there'll be no more tears. The first things will pass away. The lame will walk, and the blind will see, and the deaf will hear, and the dead will be raised to a life eternal. But what he wanted to do here is to do something for one so that everyone around could say, you know what, there is hope. To do for one, to say, you know what, he can enter my brokenness and create healing. He can bring my mourning to dancing. He can do all of this, and eventually he will. Because if we read the rest of John 10:10, it goes like this. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. See, this story is not just about what he will do. This story is about what he can do. He can raise broken marriages. He can lead people out of addiction. He can take broken lives and he can mend them back together. And he can take hopelessness and he can inject hope. Because his whole purpose is to restore what death destroys. To restore what the enemy has stolen. And for this one moment in time, he gets angry at death and overcomes it. To show his disciples that he could, to show Lazarus that he could, but also to show death that he could. All these stories, the widow's son, Jairus' daughter, Lazarus, all these stories are stories about a God who conquers death so that we can experience eternity, not just after our body stops, but that we can experience eternity here. You see, we're eternal beings. We don't become eternal beings when our body stops. When we become one with Christ and we're raised to walk in newness life, we become eternal beings right then. We live with a hope right then. And this story, the resurrection, it's beautiful because it brings hope to hopelessness. It crushes hopelessness under the weight of hope. And it makes it okay to hope again. I wish for all of us, I hope for all of us, somehow we'll understand this, that we'll recognize with this sense of wonder how amazing God is, how powerful God is, that faith in him is not the absence of fear, but it's obedience in the face of fear, that we'll understand that the object of our faith is more important than the size of our faith, but that we'll also understand that God acts in his time, but he still acts.
God acts. He acts in his time, but he does act. I pray that this podcast has been a blessing to you. Comments are always welcome. You can leave them for me at Facebook. Just do a search for Narration by George. If you haven't already liked me, please like the page. Follow me on Twitter, where I am at Narration by George, or send me an email. I am george@narrationbygeorge.com. Join me next week when this podcast will again be new. In the meantime, remember, God has blessed you. Share that blessing with someone else.